Welcome to the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Mastery of Mystery, Making a Great Whodunit. Now I'm worried, is this too loud? No, I'm not deafening anybody. Okay, great. Well, thank you, everyone, for coming. It's so exciting to see a full room here today. That's fantastic. I just want to start off by thanking the festival organizers for having us here today and our sponsors who brought us here today, the Barbro Osher Pro Suecia Foundation, the Mystery Writers of America Northern California Chapter, the Norway House Foundation, and NORLA, Norwegian Literature Abroad. And speaking of our lovely sponsors, and speaking of Mystery Writers of America, MWA, we have an esteemed representative of that organization here, Lori R. King, bestselling author, who's going to say a few words about MWA.
So I'm sorry to be neither Norwegian, Swiss, or... but I will speak it for them to say thank you all for coming. I also will say that Mystery Writers of America is an organization that has two mottos. One of them is empowering the professional mystery writer since 1945. Aren't you impressed? The other one is crime doesn't pay enough. I think between the two mottos, you get an idea of who we are. If you are interested in Mystery Writers of America, we have a lot of meetings that are open to the public. These are on a piece of paper that is by the back door. Do snatch one up as you go out or visit our booth number 19, which will be a clever thing for you because none of the booths have numbers on them here. So you can find us. It's a mystery. The other one is, this is who we are, and if you're interested in joining, I have been a proud member since 1992, and I think several of this on the panel are proud mystery writers as well. So thank you. That's all I have to say. Have fun.
Thank you, Lori. So I'm going to get us started just by doing some introductions of the people who are up here today, and then we'll jump into the discussion. To my immediate left is Wendy Hornsby. Wendy has written 12 mystery novels, 10 of them in her long-running series about muckraking and crime-solving documentary filmmaker Maggie McGowan. The latest book about Maggie, Disturbing the Dark, was released last year. Wendy also writes mystery short fiction, winning the Mystery Writers of America's coveted Edgar Award for her story, Nine Sons. To Wendy's left is Ellen Kirschman, PhD. Ellen is a police and public safety psychologist who has drawn upon her years of professional experience to write both fiction and nonfiction about cops and crime. Her first book was I Love a Cop, What Police Families Need to Know. And she was also one of the co-authors of Counseling Cops, What Clinicians Need to Know. In 2013, she launched a mystery series about police psychologist Dot Meyerhoff, with the novel Burying, not Burning, which I almost burned Ben, Burying Ben. The third book in the series, The Fifth Reflection, comes out next month. And to Ellen's left, we have Vidar Sandstol. Vidar is a Norwegian crime writer. He made his debut in 2005 with a novel I will not attempt to pronounce the name of. His 2008 thriller, The Land of Dreams, translated, part of a trilogy set partially in rural Minnesota, won the Riverton Prize for Best Norwegian Crime Novel and was called literate, lyrically descriptive, and mystical in a starred review from the notorious hard to please Kirkus. I am Steve Hawkinsmith. I've written lots of mystery stuff. I have questions for you guys before we get started with our bloviating. How many of you folks here today are mystery readers? Could I have a show of hands? Oh,
wow.
Fantastic.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow.
How many of you here today are mystery writers? Okay, that's good to know. And how many of you here today can't stand mysteries at all? Good. Because I was going to have our muscle throw them out, so this is great. Wow, we're united here. This is fantastic. Well, my first question for the panel, and I'm gonna throw this at Wendy to get us started, is we may as well begin at the beginning. When setting out to make a great whodunit, where do you start?
Boy, every author, I think, has a very different answer. I always know whodunit before I start writing the book, and sometimes that's all I know, and the rest is like a big soccer game. I start down the field, and I aim toward whodunit, trying all the way to take the ball or the facts or the essential knowledge away from you, the reader. So it's a bit of a contest, I think, between me and you about who gets to make that. Oh, she's going to say it. Goal.
Mm.
Oh. So.
Alan?
Well, as some of you know, some writers are plotters. They have spreadsheets and color-coded post-it notes. And some people are pantsers, writing by the seat of their pants. I have decided that I am a combination of both, which makes me a plotzer. And I think the answer to that question will change with every single book I've written. I'm moving way more towards what Wendy just said, knowing what happens at the end of the book before I start.
Vidar?
Well, it differs from book to book, but I'm, in generally speaking, I like to write a crime novel in a more or less organic way and let it sort of just grow out from a tiny little seed, a tiny little idea. And so I don't really, like when I wrote the trilogy, which is consists of about 1,000 pages, and it took me like 5 years to write it, I didn't decide who was going to sort of be the murderer until I was at the very end of the third book. And that is because I had from the very beginning three, perhaps four different scenarios that I knew would work towards the end. And I sort of, my main intention or my main, what was important for me was to just to explore the idea that I had gotten. And that is, I write other things than just crime novels. I write other novels too, and it's with me it's the same thing always, really, that I get an idea, and then the whole thing for me is about sort of exploring that idea. Why did I get that idea? Why did this little sort of grain of thought or this sentence that I read somewhere fascinate me so much? And then I spend a couple of years finding out, and then I forget what it was.
Well, I'm just real curious. The folks who said they were mystery writers, could you put your hands up again, please? Now, this is always a fascinating question for me. Keep them up. Okay, people who plot first, who do outlines, put your hands down. Okay, that's so interesting. I can't write a word unless I know exactly where everything's going. So I outline everything. I spend weeks and weeks and weeks outlining, breaking down every single chapter, beat by beat by beat. Wow. I can't move forward unless I know where I'm going. And I'm lazy, although no writer is really lazy, because if we're writing, you know, that's a lot of effort you're putting into something that, you know, who knows what the reaction's gonna be. I hate the idea of going back and throwing stuff out. Although I just had to do that with the book I'm working on now. I had to throw out thousands and thousands of words, and I hate it. And I've found that if I outline before I start, that generally doesn't happen. Well, I'm also curious, guys, when you're first starting out, how much research do you typically do? And how often do you do too much research? Because that's a big problem for me. And we'll start with Wendy again.
Well, this is really hard. I'm a retired professor of history. For me, the great joy is the research. It's the great fun. My warden is sitting here in the middle of the audience, and he'll say sometimes, enough with the research, write the book. Right? right? Because you get so carried away. We were just talking about this wonderful site. It's called Hippopotamus, where you can find any sort of word. I don't know how to swear in French, and I needed to know some really juicy swear words. So I went on the internet and found this great site that pronounces it for you, gives you variations, gives you proper usage of every swear word that they came up with. It was fascinating. And half a day later, he says, "Do you want lunch?" And I thought, I don't think I've earned it yet. I really haven't earned it yet. So the problem is knowing when you're when you've done, as Steve calls it, going down the rabbit hole, which takes you nowhere, or doing research that's essential, and it's hard. It's hard, and you only, the way that I really keep track of when enough is enough is when I look at the calendar and I know when my editor says she must have the book, and then it's time to just knock it off and write the book. And that's about it. No discipline here. I don't know how you can do what you do.
Alan?
Well, I'll just talk about my mystery books, because obviously there's a lot of research when you do nonfiction. And at least for the first three books, I did sort of minimal research because I have 30 years of stories and experiences in my head. And all of the my mystery novels are inspired by real people that I know. I've either treated them or I've been with them when something awful has happened. And so a lot of, when I started writing fiction from nonfiction, I thought at first, oh God, it's got to be easier to make this stuff up, right? Because I got a little sick of reality. But it's not easier. It's much harder. In a way, my mysteries are a way for me to sort of process for myself what I've been through as a psychologist dealing with first responders. So I might need to research, like I said, in the book that's coming out next month, has something to do with internet crimes against children. So I needed to do some research about that, but not a whole lot.
Vidar?
Well, how much and what kind of research I do differs from one book to the other, and mostly it's about reading. And when I wrote the trilogy, or rather when I lived in Minnesota a couple of years before I started writing the trilogy, I read an awful lot of local history from the northeast Minnesota, and I read a lot of Native American myths and folk tales, and I read a lot about the history of Norwegian immigration. And I think that goes for many writers. I am the kind of writer who has the ability to get completely obsessed with a subject that I'm working on, and then, like, as soon as I'm done with it, I never ever visit it again. And that's like, it's mostly a blessing, at least if you're a writer. If you're not a writer, I think it could be sort of hard for people around you if you go around talking about these things constantly instead of writing about them. But as a writer, it's a nice treat to have. And so mostly I do, either I have to do reading research, or I have to go places. Like, I wrote a novel that took place mostly in Naples in Italy, and so I had to go to Naples. I had to find out a lot of things in Naples. I just went down underground in the catacombs under Naples, and there were a lot of things going on there, I can tell you.
Now, Vidar, I don't know if in Norway they have the concept of the tax deduction. Is that something you guys have?
Yeah, I deducted everything. Yeah.
They're wonderful. Even in Norway, a writer is a writer. Yeah. Well, I'm going to start this one with Alan. I'm just curious, when you're first setting off down the path to start a new mystery novel, It seems to me like one of the very tricky things about writing a mystery novel is you have to find this balance between having everything make sense but keeping things mysterious, and having things be complicated enough that the reader is guessing, but you're not losing the reader and just confusing them. So what worries you, or what do you find more tricky? Keeping a plot streamlined enough to sort of keep the action going and keep the reader engaged, or building a plot that's complex enough to be a whodunit?
That question was so complex. I, You know, I don't know that I worry about any of that stuff.
Maybe that's just me. It's maybe, you do counseling, right?
Yes, Steve, but I only start with easy cases. Yeah, I really don't know how to answer. I really don't know how to answer the question. I mean, clearly we have to put out some red herrings and have to not reveal too much too soon. But since I, other than having the goalposts, don't really know what's going to happen in between page one and page whatever, I'm not that
neurotic,
self-conscious. Yeah, neurotic, OCD. I'm not that obsessive about it.
Mm-hmm. Vidar, what do you think? I mean, I guess what I'm trying to get at is it's something that I wrestle with when I'm doing the plotting of a mystery book, is, you know, it's trying to find the right balance between momentum to keep people returning the pages, but building a satisfying, and maybe we could get into this maybe at some point, is sort of the difference between the different kinds of subgenres. But I've written a lot of books that sort of are more in the Christie tradition, where there's, you know, fair play mystery. So it's very important to build in the clues and build in the red herrings, etc. Not all mysteries work like that. Oh my, I think I got lost in this question now. Vidar, how hard is it to do mystery novels?
Sorry? Well, at least when I start writing a novel, I generally don't worry about anything. When I'm not writing a novel, I worry about everything. And so my great joy in life, except for my family, I guess I have to say, but in addition to my family, my great joy in life is to sit alone in my office at home and write books, and especially just to sit and think about the next book I'm going to write, and without really plotting or anything, but just letting the sort of the sense of the book flow through me. That is really, really the best part of it, and that's where I feel that I'm totally at home in my role as a writer. And then from then on, I just sort of go with the flow. And when it's a mystery novel, obviously sooner or later you have to sort of stop and you have to cut away things and start over again. But I really can't start by planning everything like that. I have to start with the initial drive and the initial fascination for the idea. Yeah.
Wendy?
I think the book starts essentially as a simple plan. I don't write whodunits or even howdunits. Often the crime is obvious. But the bigger question for me is the social question of why. Why done it? And then what's the effect of this crime on society as a whole? Because you think of every crime like a murder, the ultimate crime, is like a ripple, right? A little drop that just ripples generation after generation through layers of society. But I think of each book starts as a simple plan. And then think of the simple plans in your life. Then there's a complication. Another person comes on scene with their own ideas about things. And so it's a matter of layering. The plot line is rather a straight line. But as you add layers of new characters, new issues, new insights, that line becomes opaque and opaque and opaque. And you just hope that toward the end it comes out and is clear enough to the reader that they don't throw the book across the room. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't always happen.
Well, Ellen, I'm going to start again with you this time and ask hopefully a more straightforward question. How important is it, do you think, for the protagonist to be likable, and is it possible to worry so much? It's funny how it always comes back to worry for me about making the protagonist likable that you make them boring.
Hmm. Can I answer the question you asked before, the one I didn't understand? Instead,
yeah. Yeah, go for it.
Well, I would. You got me to thinking about what's that germ of an idea that Vidar was talking about. And so I haven't written a book about this, but I'll just give you an example. I was reading an after-action report of the San Bernardino shootings, if you recall that. And one of the things that was the most difficult for the first responders, the cops in particular, was to have to walk past people who were wounded and bleeding and crying for help. But they had to secure the building because they didn't know how many shooters and where they were. So they could, and that they could not stop and attend to people who were screaming for help. And I begin to think about, what is that like psychologically? What does that do to a first responder whose whole rationale for being is to help somebody, to have to walk past them? And how long does that stick with? So that, now, how do I make a mystery out of that? I haven't a clue at this point. But that's just an example of what might, that kind of little germ of a thing that gets me going.
Yeah. And now a follow-up question. How important do you think it is to make your protagonist likable?
Okay. Well, people ask me, is Dot Meyerhoff, by the way, that's named after my mother and my maternal grandmother. how autobiographical is she? Well, she's pretty autobiographical, except she does things I would have gotten fired for as a psychologist, like, you know, breaking and entering, assault with a deadly weapon, stuff like that. So it is not necessarily truly autobiographical. Her love interest in the book, a guy named Frank, I have plagiarized my husband's entire life, mostly with his permission. So, you know, I think she's likable. I mean, I'm writing about serious things, but I'm also a person who loves humor. So I want her to, you know, she has a sort of offbeat view of life. I would like to make people smile as they read the book. It's not entirely, so the whole thing is not entirely grim. I guess I have to like her because I have to live with her.
Vidar?
Yeah, I think there's a great difference between, liking a person in real life and liking a novel character. And you can very well like or even love novel characters who are, if you sort of translated them into real life, that would be a pain in the back. But my main character in the trilogy is Lance Hansen, who is a local cop in Minnesota, and I certainly like him as a novel character. It was I really missed him when the trilogy was over, and I know that a lot of readers liked him a lot. But if he had been a real person, I would never have even considered spending more than a few minutes with him, because he would have bored me to death with his obsession with his own family history and the local history and all this. But then again, I'm the one who made him like that, so maybe I deserve to meet him in real life. But yeah, there's really a big, when people talk about liking or likability in novel characters, one should remember that's a big difference between likability as we know it between real people and likability in a novel character. You can love a novel character who you would never have liked if it was a real person.
Wendy?
I like that very much. I think that what you really aim at is not making the character so much likable as just beguiling enough for people to find interesting to stick to the end of the book with, but also then to be interested in enough to pick up the next book if you're writing a series. So, as Vidar says, there are characters that you really enjoy hanging out with during the course of a book that you probably wouldn't want to sit down to coffee with, but are again, beguiling. I have an ongoing character. His name's Guido, because I think everybody needs a Guido, you know? And he does some pretty stupid things, and he does some things that if I knew him as a person, I'd never I'd never be a friend of his. But I love him in the book because I love the messes he gets into that he needs saving from, or the situations that he gets everybody into. He's that kind of annoying cousin that always shows up at the holidays, right, that you just kind of have to put up with. But he's not, I find him, he would be personally annoying, but I find him interesting as part of a story, as a story unfolds. And when I don't put him in a book, I hear about it. Where's Guido? What happened to Guido?
Right.
And boy, that's something else, is writing not only your protagonist to be interesting, beguiling, but the side characters as well, the continuing characters. And it's hard, you know, to bring each one of them along, especially when Maggie's traveling around the world now. What do you do with all these people? You'd have to have a charter flight to get everybody off the ground. So. Now and then, well, one of them I just had take himself out. It was just, I just didn't have room for him. And there you go. So that, it's a problem. Mm-hmm. What's likable and what's too likable?
Mm-hmm. Well, that just, what you just said there brought up another interesting thought for me, or I hope interesting for all of us, which is you were talking about, you know, like hearing from your readers and then having to sort of keep that in mind, that feedback. And so I'm wondering for all of us, to what degree we listen to our readers or listen to our critics, and how much those voices are in our heads as we're approaching our next work. And I'll start with Vidar.
I don't listen to any of them.
So none of you matter. That's your takeaway.
You matter. Every time I meet you, you matter. But I don't listen to other people as far as my next book goes. If I did, it would be impossible to write books because people have so different opinions on books. So you can't even do that with critics. You know, listen to critics. Well, sometimes maybe, and that's so rare, I don't think I've ever experienced it, but maybe a critic can write something in a review that actually makes you see something new about your own authorship. I never experienced it. But and then, of course, you should take the consequences of that. But except for that, you can't go on like reading a novel, reading a review that says that you're brilliant, and then, oh yeah, I'm going to go on like I did in the last book, and then you start and you write three chapters, and then you read a bad review and you have to start all over again. Doesn't work that way. You just have to know who you are as a writer, and then if people like that, then you should be very thankful and happy. Yeah.
Ellen?
Well, I always have beta readers before the book is published, because that's when I can really use the feedback, and I try to do that with some discernment, because I'm not interested in everyone's opinion, like Vidar said. So I have some people that I really trust. I always have a cop read my books, because I want to see if there are some procedural issues in there that are really, I've gotten them wrong. There was actually an online lottery between a bunch of cops, wondering which one of them made up my character, Eddie Rimbauer, who is probably a beloved, like yours, a beloved character, but he's kind of a mouthy, badge-heavy, drunk cop. And I wouldn't want to go anywhere with him or spend 3 minutes with him, but he's a great character, and I use him to say some impolitic, uncorrect kinds of things. So I like some feedback. I think the most difficult feedback I got about Dot was, and I was once doing a book reading in a store, and there must have been, I don't know, 15 people there, and some people said she took too many risky things for a woman in her 50s who has a PhD. That they didn't find that plausible, which is, plausibility is a very important concept when writing mysteries. And half, so I asked for a vote, and half the room thought that was great. They loved her for doing that, and the other half the room thought it was implausible. So my beta readers and I had some serious discussion, and I have toned her down a little bit. So I did. It made sense to me, the feedback I got.
Wendy?
I don't read the reviews except to find enough words to use in a quotable blurb. Or to rearrange them in a way that's not too obvious. I had a letter once from the wonderful Charles Champlin, who always made sure he had a quotable word in every film or book review, because it would show up big and it would say, terrific. what he might have said, this is the most terrific example of a piece of junk I've ever seen, right? That it would just be terrific. So that's what I look for in a review. I don't go online and look at the reviews in Amazon or BookReads or anywhere else because they're distracting and they have really nothing to do with what I do or the book. I listen to readers in situations like this. They'll say, what did you do to Mike? I listen. I didn't bring him back from the dead, but I love to hear that people are so engaged with a character that they're listening, that they're thinking about, or that they cared about that character. But my beta reader is over here, my warden, Paul, and he reads for logic, plausibility, and chronology, so I don't slip from Tuesday to Wednesday and back again in two chapters, and I treasure that. And my editor, Meredith Phillips, is just brilliant, and she's like the mom of the book. She brings me up short, and beyond that, I write the book.
Yeah, I used to read what people were saying about me more than I do now, because what I learned was something that maybe other people are familiar with, which is hate is gonna hate. You know, no matter how spectacular one's book might be, there will be haters. Whenever you go to Yelp, you'll see that the best restaurant in the world has 50 one-star reviews because somebody came in and there was a smudge on their glass, and they're never going to get over it. So, the negativity I always found stuck with me much more than anything positive. You know, you can read 50 great reviews and pat yourself on the back, and then you meet that one person who found the smudge on your book, and it bothers you, and it's in your head when you sit down to write again, and it's just not helpful. So I tend to, my Google alerts is off. It has been for a long time. I'm going to throw down to Vidar one more time here and ask a question about mysteries, which is why we're here. Why mysteries? Why mysteries for you? You said you've written all kinds of different books.
Yeah. Well, it really started when I lived in Minnesota. I had already published three novels then, and I ended up in the States just by coincidence. I met a woman whom I liked, and for some odd reason she liked me. We've been together for 15 years, so I'm starting to believe that she might like me. and she was American, so I moved to the States. It was easier for me to move here than for her to move to Norway then. Now we live in Norway, and she lived in Kentucky, and she's a biologist, and she got a job with the U.S. Forest Service up in Minnesota, and I ended up in Minnesota by sheer coincidence among the descendants of the lutefisk-eating Norwegians. And this whole experience, both culturally and not least the landscape, the Great Lake Superior and the forest, it just made such a huge impact on me. It just made such a huge impression. I never got over it. And I knew immediately when I got up there that I had to write something from there. But I had no idea what to write. I just thought maybe I'll write like a sort of a big, more essay-like thing about the immigration or about the lake or, but then at some point, my wife and I, it was actually 4th of July 2004, we drove from where we lived and up to Canada to buy prescription drugs and Canadian bacon. And when we passed a rather dodgy looking motel called the Whispering Pines, my wife said, "That doesn't that look like the murder scene in a murder mystery?" And we started sort of musing about what kind of a murder might have taken place there, like perhaps it was a Norwegian who had come over to visit his family and got poisoned with lutefisk or some of the other Norwegian delicacies that they tend to serve you. Well, after a while we started talking about what kind of a policeman might be likely to investigate the murder, and we based these speculations on our our experience with the men of the North Minnesota, which is pretty much like the men of the North where I come from. So we ended up with this guy, Lance Hansen. We talked about this for about a year. Whenever we went out on a long ride and we ran out of something to talk about, we picked up the thread again and talked about Lance Hansen and how would he have reacted in this and that or that situation, and does he drink or doesn't he drink or is he divorced? Or whatever, and after a year I had a whole character and his family and his history worked out, and as soon as we moved to Norway I just sat down and started writing, and by then we had made him so he was a policeman, and I didn't really mean to write a crime novel, and I didn't actually know that I had written a crime novel until I won the prize for the best crime novel that year. Because it's not a very typical whodunit novel. It's much more of, it's also like a sort of a chronicle of a local community and the history, and especially the meetings between the Native Americans of the area, the Ojibwe people, and first the French voyageurs and the English, and then all the Scandinavians who came there. So it's much more than just a murder mystery. Now I can't remember the question.
Why mysteries? So.
Oh yeah, okay. So that's why.
You didn't mean to. Yeah, it was an accident. Ellen?
Well, I mean, obviously I'm a crime junkie. If I've been dealing with the cops for 30 years, I mean, I like excitement, I like action. I don't think I've got the writing chops for literary fiction. I mean, that's just another whole ball game. And as I mentioned earlier, I got sick of reality. I thought I could make stuff up more easily. And as I said, that turned out not to be true. I don't know. What I like about writing so much is the puzzle of it all. You know, teaching myself a new skill and trying to figure out, you know, how do you get the ball down the end of the field? What is this all about? And then working on the actual craft of writing as I'm doing it. And I guess I was also inspired by a lot of lousy mysteries. And I'd read these things and I'd go, good gravy, I could do better than that.
Wendy?
I read mysteries growing up, as I think a lot of you have as well, right? Nancy Drew and Trixie Belden and the Hardy Boys and so on. Those were great fun. And then I graduated to my mom's Agatha Christie's and so on and so on. When I was in the middle of the grind of graduate school in history, and when you think about it a little bit, history and mystery kind of go together, right? You're going through the lives of dead people trying to figure out what the hell happened. Right? So in the midst of this slog, as I remember it now, a favorite professor and I would swap mysteries back and forth. And we did Niall Marsh and Dorothy L. Sayers and various others. It was this delicious relief, but you're staying within that puzzle mode, right? How did this happen? Are these logical? Is this evidence logical? Could this pass a term paper test or a thesis or a dissertation test? Does this actually work? And by the time I finished and had been hired to teach, which happened actually on the same day, I was supposed to spend a summer preparing a syllabus and fall lectures, and I had run out of things I really wanted to read, and I had read my way through Margaret Millar, who I adore, a California writer. And I thought, you know, I'll just write it. I'd always known I would end up writing, but writing academic things, which I've done, is very, very different from writing fiction. And what bothered me about writing academic things or writing history is that you don't get to change the end. You don't get to change the players. You don't get to say, don't go into the basement alone, right? And I think I wanted that control over all of these things. And so instead of preparing lectures as I should have been, I started writing my first mystery and put it aside for a few years, and then kids came, so on and so on, and then I started writing seriously and found a workshop of good and serious writers in Southern California, and with their help, their criticism, their nudging, managed to finish a first mystery. And so it's part of the process. So I was doing simultaneously teaching pretending it's the facts. What are the facts? Do we know anymore? And then making it up the way I wanted it to be, and it was very, very satisfying.
I'll tell my little origin story real quick, because I think the writers here might find it interesting or helpful. About 20 years ago, I decided that I wanted to be a writer because I sucked as a musician. And I really still had that creative impulse, and I just wanted to make cool stuff, and I can't paint, and I can't draw, and I stink at the trumpet. So, I'd always been a pretty decent writer. So, I had been a big science fiction and fantasy fan as a teenager. Had read Isaac Asimov's science fiction magazine for a lot of years, and as I had mentioned earlier, I am lazy, and so I thought, I don't want to, and I also mentioned I hate throwing stuff out, I don't want to spend God knows how long writing a novel only to find out at the end that it's terrible. Now, of course, almost every writer does that eventually, at least once.
A day?
Yes. But starting out, I wanted to try to avoid that. So what I thought was, and this is where I said, like, this was actually a good idea. I'll give myself credit for this. I would start with short fiction, because if you spend a few weeks writing a bad short story, you're only out a few weeks, right? And you'll get feedback pretty quickly. That stinks. So I started writing science fiction short stories, and I got the anticipated feedback, not the wanted feedback. They did stink. And after a few years of them all stinking, what I finally came to realize was that whatever strengths I might have as a writer, they don't really lend themselves to this genre. This is not the thing that works for me. And fortunately for me, there were other magazines in the world. There was Alfred Hitchcock Mystery Magazine and Ellery Queen Mystery Magazine. So there were two that paid professional rates, because we haven't talked about it yet. Money does come into play a little bit with the writing sometimes. Or at least validation, that I wanted to know if I'd done something good. How do I know it's good? Well, somebody buys it, right? That, if they give me money for it, it must be okay. So I started writing for Ellery Queen and Alfred Hitchcock, and instead of writing for years and getting those generic rejection slips, maybe every so often with a little scrawl in the corner of like, this one was close, like, yeah, thanks, I started selling stories. So I got that validation, and I kept going, and I figured out eventually, oh, I guess I'm a mystery writer now. Woohoo! And here I am today. Well, I'm going to go back to starting with Wendy for this one. It was interesting to hear when we were talking more sort of about process that people have shifted around a bit. I still write every novel pretty much the same way. But although I found strangely that it gets harder as the years go by, not easier. But I'm wondering, like, did you do anything when writing your first book that you learned not to do, or you look back on and think, what the hell was I thinking?
Well, and once again, every day it's what the hell am I thinking? My first book came out in 1988, so this has been a long process of learning. I was making in my first book that shift between the faux neutral voice of academic writing and the fiction voice, and that was tough. And so with that book, I had a great deal of help from this wonderful group of writers, most of whom have gone on to be published authors. I won't tell you who they are publicly, but ask me later. I'm very proud of all of us. And they helped me create finally a book, and when it was done, I handed it to an agent who had been introduced to me, and then she sold it. So I don't have one of those big, crazy stories, because it had taken a couple of years to craft that book with a great deal of help. And after I was published and had sort of come out of the group first, they didn't critique me anymore. He's like, you've been published, what can I tell you? You're like, you've got the secret knowledge, I can't tell you anything anymore. And so I had to listen to their voice on my shoulder and did this more and more by myself with just a couple of consistent readers who are friends, but over time I've shed those people. I still hear their voice. You can't get away with that, right, is usually what I hear. Or you need more foundation or what? So I hear them, but I do it by myself now, and it used to be a more community process, and now I sit down at the computer and aim at the deadline, which is always way too close because Christmas came first, and then we had a whole lot of company, and you know that goes, and you know, or the kids got sick, or you name it, and do it more organically, but just more in a straight shot than I used to do. The rewriting happens consistently. I started writing on my beloved IBM Selectric typewriter. You think very hard before you type a page, because if you have to change something, you have to type the whole page over, right? You remember that? Mark Twain wrote Huckleberry Finn in one draft because he wrote it by hand. So did Louisa May Alcott. Well, now I compose on the computer, and so the whole process of thinking the word, developing the story, it happens in a more fluid way. So, you know, I can't define it. It's just, you know, over time, your whole process of writing evolves. It's never easier, by the way. I have to turn around and look. I have a bookshelf with all my books and anthologies of my short stories. And every once in a while, I have to turn around and say, you know, you've done this before. You could do it again.
Alan, lessons learned.
Okay. If I had to work on a Selectric typewriter or do it by hand, you wouldn't see me sitting here.
Yeah.
So, two major things. You all know that when you write a first draft, it's known as the crappy first draft, right? And you have to do that. So my crappy first draft of my first mystery, Burying Ben, I actually wrote in the third person. And it was really crappy. So when I got that feedback from one of my beta readers, I thought, you know, let me try this in the first person. And that's where I found my voice. So that was my first mistake, or my first, you know, aberrant attempt to do that. The second mistake I made was I was really in the pantsing world there. I had no idea who did what and why. Literally until I got to the end of the book that I sort of figured it out. And it took me many years to write that first book. So I'm not going to do that again. Now, you know, like Wendy was saying earlier, now I know what I'm aiming for. At least I know that much of it. So that's what has changed for me.
Mm-hmm. Vidar?
Yeah, I can't really remember the first things I wrote, because I wanted to be a writer since I was a young man, around in my late teens, and it took me many years. But I knew, the strange thing is that I knew for certain what I wanted to be, but I can see now that I didn't know why. I had no clue why I would be. I wanted to be a writer. It was just such a strong urge in me, and stronger than anything else, really. And I just had to become a writer. And today, I can say that there are, like for everybody else, I guess, a lot of different reasons why I am a writer. One thing is that I can't do anything else. It's the only thing that I'm slightly good at. I can hardly tie my own shoelaces, but I think that deep down it's just something I know for sure that if I couldn't write, if not if I didn't have anything to write about, but if sort of for what some odd reason I was not allowed to write at all, I would become an extremely unhappy and not very pleasant person to be around. So to me, it's such a part of me that I can't in any way sort of try to separate it from who I am. So it's a totally sort of organic thing. So I guess I was, if not born a writer, I'm certainly going to die a writer.
Now I have another question for everybody out there. We are going to do Q&A at some point, and I'm just sort of curious, like, when will we get to the Q&A? How many of you have burning questions? Okay, we might wait a little longer in the Q&A then. Maybe we'll talk a little more with my Q's and your A's. That wasn't, okay. For a second I was afraid I said something inappropriate. Influences. I'm wondering if there were influences, obviously, when you got started, and I know you talked a little bit about that, and if, as you went along, if your influences shifted or if you found that you moved away from your influences. Wendy.
I'm going to go back to what Vidar said. I've known my whole life I was a writer. It's just something I've known. In second grade, my beloved teacher, Mrs. Heath, gave me her personal copy of Little Women to read, and I so fell in love with Jo because I was Jo. My folks gave me for Christmas a Jo doll, and my mother made us matching outfits. I was Jo. That's who I was going to be. And I buggered my elementary school teachers with these horrible stories that they very indulgently read out loud, and I blessed them. Unfortunately, none of them exist. but I didn't know how you became a writer, became a professional writer, where this defined you to the world. I knew I had to have a career. I had to earn some money. I didn't know how a writer could do that. And so I just launched myself off into life and always knew, and I think, again, back to history, because it is about the writing, is it not? And so I wrote, and I had an English teacher in high school, a wretched man who held up one of my essays as probably the worst example of descriptive writing he had ever seen. And then later, he came to me and asked if I could help him find an agent for his book, and I sent it back to him because it was entirely unpublishable. And there was a certain, maybe he really didn't know a damn thing, but by then I'd done 4 or 5 books. But I still am Joe. I'm Joe. I'm never very sure about anything except I'm a writer, and that it's not what I do, it's who I am.
Ellen, influences?
Gosh, I mean, everybody else was saying, I started out writing when I was an itty-bitty little kid. I don't know that I knew I was going to be a writer when I grew up, and it wasn't going to pay the rent, which my parents were soon to point out to me quite frequently. You know, I read widely. I just read a lot of stuff, and it helps me when I'm writing. Not all writers can do this, but when I'm writing and I read somebody else's really good book, it inspires me. It keeps me going. Other people, that they have to get that other voice out of their heads. So I don't know. There's just a ton of people, and I can't point to any one person. I was a Nancy Drew fan too, and all of that. But yeah, I can't point to any one person.
Mm-hmm. Vidar,
My influences has changed up through the years, but I think the first and in a way fundamental influence was reading Franz Kafka, the Czech writer Franz Kafka, when I was like 17 or 18 in high school. And that was a part, it was partly that made me want to become a writer, actually. And this is so long ago, I can't remember it in details, but there was something about, I remember reading his novel, The Castle. This was the first book I read of him. And there was something about that eerie, dreamlike Kafka world, where everything is sort of logical, but it's just that the logic is completely off in a way, that must have in some way have appealed to something in me, definitely. I just felt that this is, not that this is something I can do equally good, but that this is something that I sort of would like to be a part of, or like an element that I would like to live in, instead of the other element that I've been, you know, growing up in, where this wasn't present. And I think, although I haven't read Kafka for years now, I really think that his my reading, my initial reading of Kafka is present under everything that I write, and certainly in my mystery novels, because although Kafka didn't write mystery novels, everything was a total mystery to him, and the world was so off and so incomprehensible that and I like that kind of feeling in a mystery book, and I'm always searching for it, and it's always there. Actually, when I start writing, that feeling is there. So I think that comes from my first sort of important influence, Kafka. Yeah.
Well, speaking for myself, I had mentioned earlier that I thought originally maybe I was going to be a science fiction writer, and I just couldn't nail it, and it just so happened that when I was taking a science fiction writing class with the great Gene Wolfe, if anybody knows Gene Wolfe, wonderful man, didn't help me one bit. I just happened to be in a used bookstore, one of my favorite things in the world, and thought, well, what the heck, I've never read this guy, and it's $1.50, and I bought The Big Sleep by Raymond Chandler. And by the end of the first page, I knew I was home. This is where I need to be, because it was voice. Mm-hmm. Science fiction, this is a broad sweeping statement, not so much about voice, typically. I know we can find writers who are very voicey, but that combination that you find in Chandler of voice and humor and cynicism, but optimism, all these things wrapped up together in a plot that carries you forward, that was it. And that was really what opened the door to me to say, well, maybe I should try this mystery thing. Well, you guys have been fabulous, and I understand some of you out there have questions. So we have a wireless mic that I think we're going to need to pass around, because this is being recorded for podcast purposes. So who had some questions? Yes, could you help with the... Thank you. We have a question there?
We can share.
Thank you. I was wondering if each of you could please talk a little bit about the mechanics of your method. How long do you write for? What time of day? Do you turn the phone off? Coffee or tea? I mean, anything specific about your method would be appreciated. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can start. My days are pretty much the same always, because I have a little boy who's 6 years old, go to school. So I drive my son to school, my wife takes the bus to her work job at the college, and then I just come home and I drink a big glass of iced tea. It's, my wife is from Texas, so there's always iced tea in the fridge, and I make myself a cup of coffee and I write from around 8:30, I guess, till around noonish, and I have a short lunch break, and then I write for another 2 hours, and I can't really turn off the phone, because if there's something should happen in school or stuff, but I certainly hate it when people call me, which they often do, and especially people call me to sell me things while I'm in the middle of something, and I'm not a very nice guy to run into then on the phone when I'm working. So, but yes, I like to write in the same way every day, in the same place every day. I'm not very good at it. I'm not the kind of guy who can just sit at the airplane and write. But what I can do is to, like I've been doing now here in Berkeley and at the hotel, I go through the manuscript and I sort of rewrite thing and I brush up things and I make it better. But I can't really write new stuff anywhere else but in my office. So I hope that house doesn't burn down, because then I don't know where to write.
No method. No routine. There's a couple of things that I can't do. I cannot listen to music. Some writers like to listen to music. To me, the rhythm of a sentence is very important. And if I listen to music, it interferes with that. I work from home, as does my husband. And he actually wants to talk to me. And he doesn't understand. I mean, I've written, several books about how hard it is to be married to a cop, how hard it is to be married to a firefighter. Well, I think it's terrible to be married to a writer. I mean, I'm always someplace else. I mean, I look like I'm there, but I'm not. I'm, in my head someplace. So I don't. I'm not disciplined. I would like to be more disciplined, and I also, I think maybe people don't appreciate the physical difficulties of writing. You know, sitting is the new poison. So I can no longer sit for, I try to put a timer on my machine and get up every 45 minutes and walk around, but it's really hard on the body to keep sitting. So I can do maybe 2 hours, and then I need a really long break if I can put in a little bit more time.
When I was still teaching and mothering, I only had this much time in every single day, and I knew exactly when it would be, and that's when I sat down and I wrote for that period of time, whatever time of day it was, and however long that was. I retired. It was so much easier when I had this nice schedule to work on than it is on a beautiful day like this, right? There are so many things to see and to do, and my garden is finally in blossom. But the routine is, you know, morning papers, a little breakfast, a little chat with the husband, and then with a big iced tea, I'd get along with your wife just fine, a big iced tea, I go downstairs, and the first thing I do is reread what I've written to get back in that place, to remember where I was, what I was doing. And then I'm back in the story, and then I edit what I've done before, and I go back through the story, and that takes however long it takes, and some days I don't get beyond that, because sometimes those are the days I throw out everything I did a week ago Tuesday and start over from that, right? So every day it starts with a big edit, and then I go on, and then I go on, and I get up, and sometimes I go out and pull some weeds, or go watch the turkeys in our backyard, or whatever's going on, go talk to somebody, take a stretch, and then with a fresh iced tea, get back at it again. I have page goals, 1,000 words a day, more or less 4 pages, which isn't too bad when you think about it. But I don't always get there, and sometimes I'll do 5,000 pages in a day, depending on where I am in the book. And where I am in the book also determines that schedule as well. Because as I get toward the end of it, the editing is less. The beginning, you're just editing, rewriting, creating the story, figuring out the characters, working out timeline, working out the story. And by the time you're 100 pages in, you know you either have something terrible or this is something you're going to stick with. And you breach that wall. It's like the marathon 11 mile, right? Is that where it is in a marathon? Not that I've ever run a marathon. But you hit this wall at 100 pages, about. And then you either leap across it or you go off in despair. And so you just keep writing, and that's it. Every day, whether I'm at home sitting in my chair in front of my computer, I'm writing. And as Vidar said, you're doing something wherever you are. You're thinking through, you're editing, you're working out story, but you're always thinking, and like Ellen, you never know where I am, even though I could be in the room next to you.
I used to be a full-time writer, and looking back on those days, it's amazing to me how much time I wasted. It's sort of galling to me, like, I should have written 10 more books. Damn, so much time on Facebook. I have kids and I have a day job now, so I write from 6 to 7 a.m. every weekday, and then also a few more hours on the weekends. And one thing that I find helpful in terms of combating my own laziness, which isn't my running theme today, is that to my left is a calendar, and on that calendar at the end of every writing period, every writing day, I write down how many words I wrote. And to my right is what I call the big board, which is a big board. And on it is a graph broken down with dates every week, moving ahead, and chapters. And I get to X them off as I go through the calendar, and I get to X off the chapters as I go through the chapters. Because again, I outline, I know exactly how many chapters it's going to be. And I just need to do that in order to apply the pressure on myself to keep going. Guilt is a powerful motivator. And if I look at that, you know, tally from the day before and see that I wrote 97 words, I'm going to feel kind of crappy. And if I look up at the big board and see that I am three X's behind, I'm going to feel kind of crappy. And I don't like to feel crappy. I like to feel good. Next question. Yes.
Hi. I'd like to hear more about your revision process, having just finished a first draft of my first crappy draft of my first novel. I'm curious to hear how you guys approach revision, and Wendy specifically, you talked about you had a group that helped you a lot with your first novel. I have a writer's workshop, but I don't know how to get to the point where I'm comfortable sharing work that I know is crappy with them versus working on it myself longer.
Wendy, do you want to go first?
Share it. Just put it out there. Just share it. If it's a good workshop, they're going to show you where your strengths are. This was great, right? And they're going to reinforce where you know it's crappy, because you know where it's crappy, right? And the importance of that workshop for you at this point is that they're what Steve's talking about. You have a deadline. If you meet regularly by X day, you better have these pages ready and copied and ready to hand out, or the reading ready to do, or you're in trouble with your group. So hand it in, participate, and most importantly, read their work, read it critically, read it hard, be honest, be generous, right? Be honest about it, because as you read them, you discover you. You really find your voice. You find out who you are. When you can pinpoint what's wrong with what they've done, you find what's wrong with what you've done. So hand it in, participate, and be there with them.
Well, actually, revision is my favorite part of the process. Somebody once said, there is no writing, there's only revision. It's like gardening, I guess, because you get to pull up a weed or, move things around that aren't blossoming where they are. I don't, by the way, garden, that's just a metaphor. So I really, the plotting part for me is really the toughest. So I really welcome the coming to revision. I never show anybody my crappy first draft. I think I have to do my revisions first, because like Wendy said, I know what isn't really working. So once I do revisions, that's when the feedback is really useful for me. And I don't know if, maybe my fellow panelists are inspiring me to be more disciplined. But, the older I get, the less I want to be pushed around by other people, and including myself. So I don't know how I would do if I had, a certain number of words I had to write every single day. I want to, time is precious. I want to do a lot of things, and there's a lot of things calling to me all the time. So I don't know. I'm sitting here mulling this over.
Yeah, I think generally speaking, if you're young and sort of new in the game, it's definitely a very good advice to listen to what experienced readers tell you and other people in the business, and not one sort of trap that some wannabe writers go into, usually men, I think, is that they tend to think of themselves as born geniuses, and if a publishing house turned them down, there's something wrong with the publishing house. There's usually something wrong with the book, and just sort of try to keep that in mind, that you can't get it right the first time anyway, and you just have to listen to people, but at the same time, obviously, listen to yourself and to what you really want to do, and sort of try to make it a dialogue and a conversation with people. So not just that you listen to them, but that you also sort of ask them why don't you like it, and then sort of try to explain to them why you did this or that, because that can be very helpful to you. Or not just when you're new, but to be very helpful to sort of explain, have to explain why did I do this, why did I write it that way, because sometimes you can then suddenly understand that what was I thinking there, and you can get some new ideas. So don't be shy about it anyway.
I would say also be very careful. I mean, I get feedback from people I don't care about their writing. I don't like their writing. So use a lot of discernment. I have a professional editor that I work with all the time, and I ask her questions. And she said, I'm the only person she's ever worked with that ever asked questions. So I'm trying to direct her feedback in a way that I know, I mean, there's a lot of help out there, but not all help is helpful. I had a writing teacher once, sort of what you were saying. This guy said to me, gee, you write absolutely beautifully and you have nothing to say. And that stopped me from writing for 2 years. And when I think back on that Adam Henry, as we would say in the police world, when I think back on that guy, what an irresponsible and cruel, unnecessary thing that he, as a teacher, it was a writing class, said to me. So you have to be generous, but you have to be careful.
Did I get the signal that we are... Okay, so do we have time for one more question? Okay, one more question. Oh, I... Do I flip a coin? Okay. Whoever was first. Yes. I don't have to decide. It's perfect.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
I want to ask you, what do you do if your characters take control and run away from you? If you have a plot in mind and the character does something else, what can you do?
Well, that's normal. That's just what they do.
Do you follow them, or do you...
Well, you know, sometimes you have to rein them in. But if you've created an independent character well, that's a full personality, and they're just like your children. You created them, but do they do what you want them to do? No, no. So, you know, you have to sometimes jerk them back and tell them you've got a story to tell, so you cannot go to Naples this week. Okay. We'll do that in another book, but if it's a good, well-started character, they always do that. Love it.
I would welcome that. You know, I mean, I used to think when I got into this that people who said their characters talked to them were smoking their socks. But I have dialogues with my characters all the time. It'd be fun if that happened.
Do you always win the conversation in the arguments?
About 50-50.
What I experience is that sort of the plot or the story takes another direction than I thought, than I had planned initially. And, well, yeah, sometimes you have to rein it in and sort of start all over again. But and then other times you can sort of detect, you can discover that this is where this story was actually headed. In the first place, and I just didn't really see the potential in it. So that's one of the most interesting things about writing, is that to see the potential in something that started like just a tiny little thought and see how much can come out of it and all the potential stories that could have come out of it, and then compose the hopefully best one. Yeah.
All right, guys, well, we should probably wrap it up. I'm sorry the folks, we didn't get to your questions. I'm sure we would love to talk to you one-on-one if you still want to come up. And we'll be signing books, I believe, downstairs. So, yeah, come on down, get some books, ask some more questions. But thank you very, very much for coming.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2017 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.